and distinguishably a hand. His face felt terrible. He must look terrible. Where am I again? Crash. Funeral. Falls. Crash. Of course. My name is... Too hard. What do I do then? That's easier. You are a paid agent of the most advanced, well, certainly the most energetic, humanoid civilization in the... reality? No. Universe? No. Galaxy? Yes, galaxy. And you were representing them at a funeral. And you were coming back on some stupid aircraft to be picked up and taken away from all this when something happened on board the aircraft and it went... And he'd seen flames and there'd been that old jungle floating right... Then nothing and pain and nothing but pain. Then drifting and floating in and out of it. The hand touched his face again. And this time there was something to see. He thought it looked like a cloud, or like a moon through a cloud, itself unseen but shining through. Possibly the two were connected, he thought. Yes, here it comes again, and yes, there we are, sensation, feeling, the hand on the face again. Throat swallowing, water or some liquid. You are being given something to drink. From the way it goes down, there seems to be... Yes, upright. We are upright, not on our back. The hands, own hands, they are... An open feeling. Feeling very open. Very vulnerable. Naked. Thinking about his body was bringing the pain back again. He decided to give up on that. Try something else. Try the crash again. Back from the funeral and the desert, coming right up... No, mountains. Or was it jungle? He couldn't remember. Where are we? Jungle? No. Desert? No. What then? Don't know. Asleep, he thought suddenly. You were asleep in the aircraft in the night and had just enough time to wake up in the darkness and see flames and begin to realize before light detonated inside your head. After that, pain. But you didn't see any sort of terrain floating, rushing up to meet you, because it was very dark. The next time he came round, everything had changed. He felt vulnerable and exposed. As his eyes opened and he tried to remember how to see, he slowly made out dusty streaks of light in a brown gloom and saw earthenware pots near a mud or earth wall and a small fireplace in the centre of the room and spears leaning against a wall and other blades. Straining his neck to bring his head up, he could see something else. The rough wooden frame he was tied to. The wooden frame was in the shape of a square. Two diagonals made an X inside the square. He was naked, his hands and feet lashed one to each corner of the frame, which was propped against a wall at about 45 degrees. A thick hide strap secured his waist to the centre of the X, and all over his body were markings of blood and paint. He relaxed his neck. Oh, shit, he heard himself croak. He didn't like the look of this. Where the hell was the culture? They ought to be rescuing him. That was their job. He did their dirty work. They looked after him. This was the deal. So where the hell were they? The pain came back, like an old friend by now, from almost everywhere. Straining his neck like that had hurt. Sore head, maybe concussion. Broken nose, cracked or broken ribs. One broken arm, two broken legs. Maybe internal injuries. His insides felt pretty sore, too. The worst, in fact. He felt bloated and full of decay. Shit, he thought. I might actually be dying. He shifted his head, grimacing. Pain poured in as if some protecting shell on his skin had been cracked by the movement, and looked at the ropes lashing him to the wooden frame. Traction was no way to treat a fracture, he told himself, and laughed very briefly, because with the first contraction of his stomach muscles, his ribs pulsed suddenly, as though they were at red heat. He could hear things, distant noises of people shouting now and again, and children yelling, and some sort of animal baying. He closed his eyes, but heard nothing more distinct. He opened them again. The wall was earth, and he was probably underground, for there were thick sawn-off roots sticking into the space around him. The light was composed of two nearly vertical shafts, slightly angled beams of direct sunlight, so near midday, near the equator. Underground, he thought, and felt sick. Nice and hard to find. He wondered if the plane had been on course when it crashed, and how far from the crash site he'd been carried. No point in worrying about it. What else could he see? Crude benches, a coarse cushion, dented. It looked like somebody had sat there facing him. He assumed it was the owner of the hand he had felt, if there had been one. There was no fire in a circle of stones set underneath one of the holes in the roof. Spears leant against the wall, and other weaponish things were strewn about the place. They were not battle weapons, ceremonial or maybe torture. He caught a whiff of something awful just then, and knew it was gangrene, and knew it must be him. He began to slip over the edge again, uncertain whether he was falling asleep or really going unconscious, but hoping for one or the other, willing either, because all this was more than he could handle just now. Then the girl came in. She had a jug in her hand and set it down before looking at him. He tried to speak, but couldn't. Maybe he hadn't really spoken earlier when he'd thought he said shit. He looked at the girl and attempted a smile. She went out again. He felt somehow heartened seeing the girl. A man would have been bad news, he thought. A girl meant things might not be so bad after all. Maybe. The girl came back with a bowl of water. She washed him, rubbing away the blood and the paint. There was some pain. Predictably, nothing happened when she washed his genitals. He'd have liked to show signs of life just for form's sake. He tried to speak, but failed. The girl let him sip some water from a shallow bowl, and he croaked at her, but nothing distinguishable. She left again. The next time she came back with some men. They wore many strange clothes, like feathers and skins and bones, and wooden tiles of armour laced with gut. They were painted too, and they brought pots and small sticks with them and used them to paint him again. They finished and stood back. He wanted to tell them he didn't suit red, but nothing came out. He felt himself falling away, out into the darkness. When he came to again, he was moving. The entire frame he was strapped to had been lifted and carted out of the gloom. He faced the sky. Blinding light filled his eyes, dust filled his nose and mouth, and shouts and screams filled his mind. He felt himself shiver like a fever victim, tearing pain from each shattered limb. He tried to shout and to raise his head to see, but all there was noise and dust. His insides felt worse, skin taut over his belly. Then he was upright again, and the village was beneath him. It was small. There were some tents, some wicker and clay dwellings, and some holes in the ground. Semi-arid, an indeterminate scrub stamped down inside the perimeter of the village, vanished quickly beyond it into a yellow glowing mist. The sun was just visible low down. He couldn't work out if it was dawn or dusk. What he really saw were the people. They were all in front of him. He was up on a mound, the frame tied to two large stakes, and the people were beneath him, all on their knees, heads bowed. There were tiny children, their heads forced down by nearby adults. There were old people held up from collapsing completely by those around them, and every age in between. Then in front of him walked three people, the girl and two of the men. The men, one on either side of the girl, lowered their heads, knelt down quickly and arose again and made a sign. The girl did not move, and her gaze was fixed on a point between his eyes. She was dressed in a bright red gown now. He could not remember what she had worn before. One of the men held a large earthenware pot. The other had a long, curved, broad-bladed sword.
"Hey!"
he croaked. He couldn't manage anything else. The pain was getting very bad now. Being upright didn't do his broken limbs any good at all. The chanting people seemed to swing about his head. The sunlight dipped and veered, and the three people in front of him became many, multiplying and wavering, unsteady in the waste of mist and dust before him. Where the hell was the culture? There was a terrible roaring noise in his head, and the diffuse glow in the midst, which was the sun, was starting to pulse. The sword glittered to one side, the earthenware pot gleamed on the other. The girl stood directly in front of him and put her hand into his hair, grasping it. The roaring noise was filling his ears, and he could not tell if he was shouting and screaming or not. The man to his right raised the sword. The girl pulled his hair, yanking his head out. He screamed above the roaring noise as his broken bones grated. He stared at the dust, at the hem of the girl's robe.
"You bastards," he thought,
not sure, even then, exactly who he meant. He managed to scream one syllable,
"El."
Then the blade slammed into his neck. The name died. Everything had ended, but it still went on. There was no pain. The roaring noise was actually quieter. He was looking down at the village and the crouching people. The view swung. He could still feel the pull of the roots of his hair straining at the skin on his scalp. He was swung round. The slack, headless body dribbled blood down its chest. "That was me," he thought. "Me." He was swung round again. The man with the sword was wiping blood from the blade with a rag. The man with the earthenware pot was trying not to look into his staring eyes and holding the pot out towards him, the lid in his other hand. "So that's what it's for," he thought, feeling somehow stunned into an eerie calmness. Then the roaring noise seemed to gather and start to fade at once. The view was going red. He wondered how much longer this could go on. How long did a brain survive without oxygen? "Now, I really am too," he thought, remembering, eyes closing. And he thought of his heart, stopped now, and only then realized and wanted to cry but could not, for he had finally lost her. Another name formed in his mind. "Da." The roar split the skies. He felt the girl's grip loosen. The expression on the face of the youth holding the pot was almost comically fearful. People looked up from the crowd. The roar became a scream. A blast of air swept dust into the air and made the girl holding him stagger. A dark shape swung quickly through the air above the village. "A little late," he heard himself think, slipping away. There was more noise for a second or two, screams maybe, and something whacked into his head, and he was rolling away, dust in his mouth and eyes. But he was starting to lose interest in all that stuff, and was happy to let the darkness wash over him. Maybe he was picked up again later, but that seemed to happen to somebody else. When the terrible noise came, and the great carved black rock landed in the middle of the village, just after the sky's offering had been separated from his body and so joined to the air, everybody ran into the thinning mist to get away from the screaming light. They gathered, whimpering at the waterhole. After only 50 heartbeats, the dark shape appeared above the village again, rising hazily into the thinner mists near the sky. It did not roar this time, but moved quickly off with a noise like the wind and shrank to nothing. The shaman sent his apprentice back to see how things stood. The quaking youth disappeared into the mist. He returned safely, and the shaman led the still terrified people back to the village. The body of the sky offering still hung limply on the wooden frame at the summit of the mound. His head had disappeared. After much chanting and grinding entrails, spotting shapes in the mists and three trances, the priest and his apprentice decided it was a good omen, and yet a warning at the same time. They sacrificed a meat animal belonging to the family of the girl who had dropped the sky offering's head and put the beast's head in the earthenware pot instead. Chapter 5.
"Dizzy, how the devil are you?"
He took her hand and helped her up onto the wooden pier from the roof of the just-surfaced module. He put his arms round her.
"Good to see you again."
He laughed. Smar patted his waist, finding herself unwilling to hug him back. He didn't seem to notice. He let her go, looked down to see the drone rising up from the module.
"And Scaffin Amtiscor, they still letting you out without a guard?"
"Hello, Zagalwe," the drone said.
He put his arm round Smar's waist.
Come on up to the shack. We'll have lunch.
All right, she said.
They walked along the small wooden pier to a stone path laid across the sand and on into the shade under the trees. The trees were blue or purple, huge puffheads of dark colour standing out against the pale blue sky and tugged at by a warm, intermittent breeze. They sweated delicate perfumes from the tops of their silver-white trunks. The drone lifted to above tree height a couple of times when other people passed on the path. The man and woman walked through the sunlit avenues between the trees until they came to where a wide pool of water trembled reflections of 20 or so white huts. A small, sleek seaplane floated at a wooden jetty. They entered the cluster of buildings and climbed some steps to a balcony that looked over the pool and the narrow channel that led from it to the lagoon on the far side of the island. The sun was sifted through the tree heads. Shadows moved to and fro along the veranda and over the small table and the two hammocks. He motioned Smar to sit on the first hammock. A female servant appeared, and he ordered lunch for two. When the servant had gone, Skaffin Antiskor floated down and sat on the parapet of the veranda's wall, overlooking the pool. Smar levered herself into the hammock carefully.
It true you own this island, Sir Calway?
Hmm?
He looked round, apparently uncertain, then nodded his head.
Oh, yes, so I do.
He kicked off his sandals and slumped into the other hammock, letting it sway. He picked up a bottle from the floor and, with each sway of the hammock, poured a little more from the bottle into two glasses on the small table. He increased the swing when he had finished to be able to hand her drink to her.
Thank you.
He sipped at his drink and closed his eyes. She watched the glass on his chest where his hands held it and watched the liquid swill this way, that way, lethargic and eye-brown. She moved her gaze to his face and saw he had not changed. Hair a bit darker than she remembered, swept away from his broad, tanned forehead and tied in a ponytail behind. Fit-looking as ever. No older-looking, of course, because they'd stabilised his age as part of his payment for the last job. His eyes opened slowly, heavy-lidded, and he looked back at her, smiling slowly. The eyes look older, she thought, but she could have been wrong.
So, she said. We playing games here, Sir Calway?
What do you mean, Dizzy?
I've been sent to get you back again. They want you to do another job. You must have guessed that. So tell me now whether I'm wasting my time here or not. I'm in no mood to try and argue you.
Dizzy, he exclaimed,
sounding hurt, pivoting his legs off the hammock and onto the floor, then smiling persuasively.
Don't be like that. Of course you're not wasting your time. I've already packed.
He beamed at her like a happy child, his tanned face open and smiling. She looked at him with relief and disbelief.
So what was all the runaround for?
What runaround? He said innocently,
sitting back in the hammock again.
I had to come here to say goodbye to a close friend, that was all. But I'm ready to go. What's the scam?
Smar stared open-mouthed. Then she turned to the drone.
Do we just go now?
No point, Skaffin Antiskor said. The course the GSV's on, you can have 2 hours here, then go back to the xenophobe. It can match with Watt in about 30 hours.
It swiveled to look at the man.
But we need a definite word. There's a teraton of GSV with 28 million people on board charging in this direction. If it's to wait here, it has to slow down first, so it needs to know for sure. You really are coming this afternoon?
Drone, I just told you I'll do it.
He leaned towards Smar.
What is the job again?
Verenhutz, she told him. Soldrin Beishai?
He beamed, teeth gleaming.
Old Soldrin still above ground? Well, it'll be good to see him again.
You have to talk him back into his working clothes again.
He waved one hand airily.
Easy, he said, drinking.
Smar watched him drink. She shook her head.
Don't you want to know why, Shiradanin? She asked.
He started to make a gesture with one hand that meant the same as a shrug, then thought better of it.
Sure. Why, Dizzyat?
He sighed.
Verenhutz is coalescing into two groups. The people gaining the upper hand at the moment want to pursue aggressive terraforming policies.
That sort of...
He burped.
Redecorating a planet, right?
Smar closed her eyes briefly.
Yes, sort of. Whatever you choose to call it, it's ecologically insensitive, to put it mildly. These people, they call themselves the humanists, also want a sliding scale of sentient rights, which will have the effect of letting them take over whatever even intelligently inhabited worlds they're militarily able to. There are a dozen brushfire wars going on right now. Any one of them could spark the big one. And to an extent, the humanists encourage these wars, because they appear to prove their case that the cluster is too crowded and needs to find new planetary habitats.
They also, Scaffan Amtiscor said, refuse to acknowledge machine sentience fully. They exploit proto-conscious computers and claim only human subjective experience has any intrinsic value, carbon fascists.
I see. He nodded and looked very serious. And you want old Beishai to get into harness with these humanist guys, right?
Shiradanin, Smar scolded, as Scaffin Amtiscor's feels went frosty. He looked hurt.
But they're called the humanists.
That's just their name, Zakalwe.
Names are important, he said, apparently serious.
It's still just what they call themselves. It doesn't make them the good guys.
Okay.
He grinned at Smar. Sorry. He tried to look more businesslike.
You want him pulling in the other direction, like last time?
Yes, Smar said.
Fine. Sounds almost easy.
No soldiering?
No soldiering.
I'll do it.
He nodded.
Do I hear the sound of a barrel bottom being scraped? Scaffin Amtiscor muttered.
Just send the signal, Smar told it.
Okay, said the drone. Signal sent.
It made a good impression of glowering at the man with its fields.
But you'd better not change your mind.
Only the thought of having to spend any time in your company, Scaffin Amtiscor, could possibly disinduce me from accompanying the delightful Miss Smar here to Verenhut's.
He glanced concernedly at the woman.
You are coming, I hope.
Smar nodded. She sipped at her drink while the servant laid some small dishes on the table between the hammocks.
Just like that, Sir Calway, she said, once the servant had gone again.
Just like what, Dizziard?
He smiled over his glass.
You're leaving. After what? 5 years? Building up your empire? Sorting out your scheme to make the world a safer place using our technology? Trying to use our methods? You're prepared just to walk away from it all, for however long it takes? Damn it! Even before you knew it was Verenhut's, you'd said yes. Could have been on the other side of the galaxy, for all you knew. Could have been the clouds. You might have been saying yes to a 4-year trip.
He shrugged.
I like long voyages.
Smar looked into the man's face for a while. He looked unworried,
full of life. Pep and vim were the words that came to mind.
She felt vaguely disgusted. He shrugged, eating some fruit from one of the little dishes.
Besides, I have a trust arrangement set up. It'll all be looked after until I come back.
If there's anything to come back to, Scaffin Amtiscor observed.
Of course there will be, he said, spitting a pip over the edge of the veranda wall. These people like to talk about war, but they aren't suicidal.
Ooh, that's all right then,
the drone said, turning away. The man just smiled at it. He nodded at Smar's untouched plate.
You're not hungry, Dizziard?
Lost my appetite, she said.
He swung out of the hammock, brushing his hands together.
Come on, he said. Let's go for a swim.
She watched him trying to catch fish in a small rock pool, paddling around in his long trunks. She had swum in her briefs. He bent down engrossed, his earnest face peering into the water, his face reflected there. He seemed to speak to it.
You still look very good, you know. I hope you feel suitably flattered.
She went on drying herself.
I'm too old for flattery, Sir Calloway.
Rubbish, he laughed,
and the water rippled under his mouth. He frowned hard and dipped his hands under, slowly. She watched the concentration on his face as his arms slid deeper under the water, mirroring themselves. He smiled again, his eyes narrowing as his hands steadied. His arms were in deep now, and he licked his lips. He lunged forward, yelled excitedly, then cupped his hands out of the water and came over to her where she sat against some rocks. He was grinning hugely. He held his hands out for her to see. She looked in and saw a small fish, brilliant, shimmering blue and green and red and gold, a gaudy splash of rippling light, squirming inside the man's cupped hands. She frowned as he leant back against the rock again.
"Now just you put that back where you found it, Sheradanine, and the way you found it."
His face fell, and she was about to say something else, kinder, when he grinned again and threw the fish back into the pool.
"As if I'd do anything else."
He came and sat beside her on the rock. She looked out to sea. The drone was further up the beach, 10 meters behind them. She carefully smoothed the tiny dark hairs on her forearms until they were lying flat.
"Why did you try all that stuff, Sir Calloway?"
"Giving the elixir of youth to our glorious leaders."
He shrugged.
"Seemed like a good idea at the time," he confessed lightly. "I don't know. I thought it might be possible. I thought interfering was maybe a lot easier than you lot made it out to be. I thought one man with a strong plan, not interested in his own aggrandizement."
He shrugged, glanced at her.
"It might all work out yet. You never know."
"Sir Calloway, it isn't going to work out. You're leaving us an incredible mess here."
"Ah," he nodded. "You are coming in, then?" "Thought you might."
"In some fashion. I think we'll have to."
"Best of luck."
"Luck,"
Smar began, but then thought the better of it. She ran her fingers through her damp hair.
"How much trouble am I in, Dizziet?"
"For this?"
"Yes, and the knife missile. You heard about that?"
"I heard." She shook her head. "I don't think you're in any more trouble than you're ever in, Sheradanine, just by being you."
He smiled.
"I hate the culture's tolerance."
"So," she said, slipping her blouse over her head, "what are your terms?"
"Pay as well, eh?"
He laughed.
"Minus the rejuve. The same as last time. Plus 10% more negotiables."
"Exactly the same."
She looked at him sadly, her wet, bedraggled hair hanging down from her shaking head. He nodded.
"Exactly."
"You're a fool, Sir Calloway."
"I keep trying."
"It won't be any different.
You can't know that. I can guess, and I can hope."
"Look, Dizzy, it's my business, and if you want me to come with you, then you've got to agree to it, all right?"
"All right."
He looked wary.
"You still know where she is?"
Smar nodded.
"Yes, we know."
"So it's agreed?"
She shrugged and looked out to sea.
"Oh, it's agreed. I just think you're wrong. I don't think you should go to her again."
She looked him in the eye.
"That's my advice."
He stood up and dusted some sand off his legs.
"I'll remember."
They walked back to the huts and the still sea pool in the center of the island. She sat on a wall, waiting while he made his final goodbyes. She listened for crying or the sound of breakages, but in vain. The wind blew her hair gently, and to her surprise, despite it all, she felt warm and well. The scent from the tall trees stretched around her, and their shifting shadows made the ground seem to move in time with the breeze, so that air and trees and light and earth swayed and rippled like the bright dark water in the island's central pool. She closed her eyes, and sounds came to her like faithful pets nuzzling her ear. Sounds of the brushing tree heads, like tired lovers dancing. Sounds of the ocean swirling over rocks, softly stroking the golden sands. Sounds of what she did not know. Perhaps soon she would be back in the house below the grey-white dam.
"What an asshole you are, Sir Calloway," she thought. "I could have stayed home. They could have sent the stand-in, damn it. They could probably have just sent the drone and you'd still have come."
He appeared looking bright and fresh and carrying a jacket. A different servant carried some bags.
"Okay, let's go," he said.
They walked to the pier while the drone tracked them overhead.
"By the way," she said, "why 10% more money?"
He shrugged as they walked onto the wooden pier.
"Inflation."
Smar frowned.
"What's that?"
Part 2. An Outing. Numeral 9.
When you sleep beside a head full of images, there is an osmosis, a certain sharing in the night. So he thought. He thought a lot then, more than he ever had, perhaps. Or maybe he was just more aware of the process and the identity of thought and passing time. Sometimes he felt as though every instant he spent with her was a precious capsule of sensation, to be lovingly wrapped and carefully placed somewhere inviolable, away from harm. But he only fully realized that later. It wasn't something he was fully aware of at the time. At the time, it seemed to him that the only thing he was fully aware of was her. He lay, often, looking at her sleeping face in the new light that fell in through the open walls of the strange house, and he stared at her skin and hair with his mouth open, transfixed by the quick stillness of her, struck dumb with the physical fact of her existence as though she was some careless star thing that slept on, quite unaware of its incandescent power. The casualness and ease with which she slept there amazed him. He couldn't believe that such beauty could survive without some superhumanly intense conscious effort. On such mornings, he would lie and look at her and listen to the sounds that the house made in the breeze. He liked the house. It seemed fit. Normally, he'd have hated it. Here and now, though, he could appreciate it and happily see it as a symbol. Open and closed, weak and strong, outside and inside. When he'd first seen it, he'd thought it would blow away in the first serious gale, but it seemed these houses rarely collapsed. In the very rare storms, people would retreat to the centre of the structures and huddle round the central fire, letting the various layers and thicknesses of covering shake and sway on their posts, gradually sapping the force of the wind and providing a core of shelter. Still, as he'd pointed out to her when he first saw it from the lonely ocean road, it would be easy to torch and simple to rob, stuck out here in the middle of nowhere. She'd looked at him as though he were mad, but then kissed him. That vulnerability intrigued and troubled him. There was a likeness to her there, to her as a poet and as a woman. It was similar, he suspected, to one of her images. The symbols and metaphors she used in the poems he loved to hear her read out loud, but could never quite understand. Too many cultural allusions, and this baffling language he'd not yet fully understood and still sometimes made her laugh with. Their physical relationship seemed to him at once more whole and complete, and more defyingly complex than anything similar he had known. The paradox of love physically incarnate, and the most personal attack being the same thing, tied knots in him, sometimes sickened him, as in the midst of this joy he fought to understand the statements and promises that might be being implied. Sex was an infringement, an attack, an invasion. There was no other way he could see it. Every act, however magical and intensely enjoyed, and however willingly conducted, seemed to carry a harmonic of rapacity. He took her, and however much she gained in provoked pleasure and in his own increasing love, she was still the one that suffered the act, had it played out upon her and inside her. He was aware of the absurdity of trying too hard to develop the comparison between sex and war. He had been laughed out of several embarrassing situations trying to do so. "The Calwe," she would say, when he tried to explain some of this, and she would put her cool, slim fingers behind his neck and stare out from the rumbustious, black tangle of her hair. "You have serious problems." She would smile. But the feelings, the acts, the structure of the two were to him so close, so self-evidently akin, that such a reaction only forced him deeper into his confusion. But he tried not to let it bother him. At any time he could simply look at her and wrap his adoration for her around himself like a coat on a cold day, and see her life and body, moods and expressions and speech and movements as a whole enthralling field of study that he could submerge himself in, like a scholar finding his life's work. "This was more like it," some small, remindful voice inside him said. "This is more like the way it's supposed to be. With this, you can leave all that other stuff behind. The guilt and the secrecy and the lies, the ship and the chair and the other man. but he tried not to listen to that voice. They'd met in a port bar. He'd just arrived and thought he'd make sure their alcohol was as good as people had said. It was. She was in the next dark booth, trying to get rid of a man. "You're saying nothing lasts forever," he heard the fellow whine. Well, pretty trite, he thought. "No," he heard her say. "I'm saying with very few exceptions, nothing lasts forever. And amongst those exceptions, no work or thought of man is numbered." She went on talking after this, but he homed in on that. That was better, he thought. "I liked that. She sounds interesting. Wonder what she looks like." He stuck his head round the corner of the booth and looked in at them. The man was in tears. The woman was, well, lots of hair. Very striking face, sharp and almost aggressive. Tidy body. "Sorry," he told them, "but I just wanted to point out that nothing lasts forever can be a positive statement. Well, in some languages." Having said it, it did occur to him that in this language it wasn't. They had different words for different sorts of nothing. He smiled, ducked back into his own booth, suddenly embarrassed. He stared accusatorily at the drink in front of him. Then he shrugged and pressed the bell to attract a waiter. Shouts from the next booth, a clatter and a little shriek. He looked round to see the man storming off through the bar, heading for the door. The girl appeared at his elbow. She was dripping. He looked up into her face. It was damp. She wiped it with a handkerchief. "Thank you for your contribution," she said icily. "I was bringing things to a conclusion quite smoothly there until you stepped in." "I'm very sorry," he said. "Not at all." She took her handkerchief and wrung it out over his glass, dribbling. "Hmm," he said. "Too kind." He nodded at the dark spots on her grey coat. "Your drink or his?" "Both," she said, folding the kerchief and starting to turn away. "Please, let me buy you a replacement." She hesitated. The waiter arrived at the same moment. Good omen, he thought. "Ah," he said to the man, "I'll have another, whatever it is I've been drinking, and for this lady?" She looked at his glass. "The same," she said. She sat down across the table. "Think of it as reparations," he said, digging the word out of the implanted vocabulary he'd been given for his visit. She looked puzzled. "Reparations. That's one I'd forgotten. Something to do with war, isn't it?" "Yep," he said, smothering a belch with one hand. "Sort of like damages?" She shook her head. "Wonderfully obscure vocabulary, but totally bizarre grammar." "I'm from out of town," he said breezily. This was true. He'd never been within 100 light-years of the place. "Shias Engin," she nodded. "I write poems." "You're a poet," he said, delighted. "I've always been fascinated by poets. I tried writing poems once." "Yes," she sighed and looked wary. "I suspect everyone does. And you are?"
"Sheradanin Zakalwe. I fight wars."
She smiled. "I thought there hadn't been a war for 300 years. Aren't you getting a little out of practice?"
"Yeah, boring, isn't it?"
She sat back in the seat, took off her coat.
"From just how far out of town have you come, Mr. Zakalwe?"
"Ah, heck, you've guessed."
He looked downcast.
"Yeah, I'm an alien."
"Oh, thank you." The drinks arrived. He passed one to her.
"You do look funny," she said, inspecting him.
"Funny?"
he said indignantly. She shrugged.
"Different."
She drank.
"But not all that different."
She leaned forward on the table.
"Why do you look so similar to us? I know all the outworlders aren't humanoid, but a lot are. How come?"
"Well," he said, hand at his mouth again, "it's like this,
he belched.
"The dust clouds and stuff in the galaxy are, it's food, and its food keeps speaking back to it. That's why there are so many humanoid species, Nebulae's last meals repeating on them."
She grinned.
"That simple, is it?"
He shook his head.
Nah, not at all. Very complicated. But, he held up one finger, I think I know the real reason.
Which is?
Alcohol in the dust clouds. Goddamn stuff is everywhere. Any lousy species ever invents the telescope and the spectroscope and starts looking in between the stars, what do they find? He knocked the glass on the table. Loads of stuff, but much of it, alcohol. He drank from the glass. Humanoids are the galaxy's way of trying to get rid of all that alcohol.
It's all starting to make sense now,
she agreed, nodding her head and looking serious. She looked inquisitively at him.
So why are you here? Not come to start a war, I hope.
No, I'm on leave. Come to get away from them. That's why I chose this place.
How long are you here for?
Till I get bored.
She smiled at him.
And how long do you think that will take?
Well, he smiled back, I don't know. He put his glass down. She drained hers. He reached out for the button to call the waiter, but her finger was already there.
My turn, she said. Same again?
No, he said. Something quite different this time, I feel. When he tried to tabulate his love, list all the things about her that drew him to her, he found himself starting at the larger facts. Her beauty, her attitude to life, her creativity. But as he thought over the day that had just passed, or just watched her, he found individual gestures, single words, certain steps, a single movement of her eyes or a hand, starting to claim equal attention. He would give up then, and console himself with something she'd said, that you could not love what you fully understood. Love, she maintained, was a process, not a state. Held still, it withered. He wasn't too sure about all that. He seemed to have found a calm, clear serenity in himself he hadn't even known was there. Thanks to her. The fact of her talent, maybe her genius, played a role too. It added to the extent of his disbelief, this ability to be more than the thing he loved, and to present to the outside world an entirely different aspect. She was what he knew, here and now, complete and rich and measureless, and yet, when both of them were dead, and he found he could think about his own death again now without fear. A world, at least, many cultures perhaps, would know her as something utterly dissimilar. A poet, a fabricator of sets of meanings that to him were just words on a page or titles that she sometimes mentioned. One day, she said she would write a poem about him, but not yet. He thought what she wanted was for him to tell her the story of his life, but he had already told her he could never do that. He didn't need to confess to her. There was no need. She had already unburdened him, even if he did not know quite how. Memories are interpretations, not truth, she insisted, and rational thought was just another instinctive power. He felt the slowly healing polarization of his mind, matching his to hers, the alignment of all his prejudices and conceits to the lodestone of the image she represented for him. She helped him, and without knowing it. She mended him, reaching back to something so buried he'd thought it inaccessible forever, and drawing its sting. So perhaps it was also that which stunned him. The effect this one person was having on memories so terrible to him that he had long ago resigned himself to them only growing more potent with age. But she just ringed them off, cut them out, parcelled them up and threw them away, and she didn't even realize she was doing it, had no idea of the extent of her influence. He held her in his arms.
How old are you?
She'd asked, near dawn on that first night. Older and younger than you.
Cryptic crap. Answer the question.
He grimaced into the darkness. Well, how long do you people live?
I don't know. 80, 90 years?
He had to remember the length of the year here. Close enough. Then I'm about 220, 110, and 30. She whistled, moved her head on his shoulder.
A choice.
Sort of. I was born 220 years ago. I have lived for 110 of them, and physically I'm about 30. The laughter was deep in her throat.
He felt her breasts sweep across his chest as she swung on top of him.
I'm fucking a 110-year-old.
She sounded amused. He laid his hands on the small of her back, smooth and cool.
Yeah, great, isn't it? All the benefits of experience without the con...
She came down, kissing him. He put his head to her shoulder, drew her tighter. She stirred in her sleep, moved too, her arms around him, drawing him to her. He smelled the skin of her shoulder, breathing in the air that had been on her flesh, was scented by her, perfumed by no perfume, carrying her own smell only. He closed his eyes to concentrate on this sensation. He opened them, drew in her sleeping look again, moved his head to hers, his tongue out, flickering under her nose to feel the flow of breath, anxious to touch the thread of her life. The tip of his tongue and the tiny hollow between her lips and her nose vexed and caved, as if designed. Her lips parted, closed again. Her lips rubbed against each other side to side, and her nose wrinkled. He watched these things with a secret delight, as fascinated as a child playing boo with an adult who kept disappearing round the side of a cot. She slept on. He rested his head again. That first morning, in the grey dawn, he had lain there while she inspected his body minutely.
So many scars, Zakalwe,
she said, shaking her head, tracing lines across his chest.
I keep getting into scraps, he admitted. I could have all these healed completely, but... they're good for... remembering.
She put her chin on her chest.
Come on, admit you just like showing them off to the girls.
There is that too.
This one looks nasty, if your heart's in the same place as ours, given that everything else seems to be.
She ran her finger round a little puckered mark near one nipple. She felt him tense and looked up. There was a look in the man's eyes that made her shiver. Suddenly, he seemed all the years he'd claimed, and more. She drew herself up, ran her hand through her hair.
That one's still a bit fresh, huh?
That's...
He made the effort of trying to smile, and ran his own finger over the tiny dimpled crease on his flesh.
That's one of the oldest, funnily enough.
The look faded from his eyes.
This one?
She said brightly, touching one side of his head.
Bullet.
In a big battle?
Well, sort of. In a car, to be precise. A woman.
Oh, no.
She clapped a hand to her mouth, mimicking horror.
It was very embarrassing.
Well, we won't go into that one. What about this?
Laser. A very strong light, he explained, when she looked puzzled. Much longer ago.
This one?
Combination of things. Insects, in the end.
Insects?
She quivered. And he was back there, in the drowned volcano. A long time ago now, but still there. Still within him. And still safer to think about than the crater over his heart, where another, even more ancient memory dwelt. He remembered the caldera, and saw again the pool of stagnant water, the stone at its centre, and the surrounding walls of the poisoned lake. He felt once more the long, slow scrape his body had made, and the intimacy of insects. But that remorseless concentricity didn't matter any more. Here was here, and now was now.
You don't want to know, he grinned.
I think I'll take your word for that, she agreed,
nodding slowly, the long black hair swinging heavily.
I know. I'll kiss them all better.
Could be a long job, he told her, as she swiveled and moved to his feet.
You in a hurry? She asked him, kissing a toe.
Not at all.
He smiled, lying back.
Take all the time you want. Take forever.
He felt her move and looked down. Her knuckles rubbed her eyes, her hair spilled. She patted her nose and cheeks and smiled at him. He looked at her smile. He had seen a few smiles he might have killed for, but never one he'd have died for. What else could he do but smile back?
Why do you always wake before me?
I don't know.
He sighed. So did the house, as the breeze moved its equivocal walls.
I like watching you sleep.
Why?
She rolled and lay on her back, turning her head to him, the hair rolling bounteously to him. He laid his head on that dark, fragrant field, remembering the smell of her shoulder, stupidly wondering if she smelt different awake than asleep. He nuzzled her shoulder, and she laughed a little, shrugging that shoulder and pressing her head against his. He kissed her neck and answered before he forgot the question completely. When you're awake, you move, and I miss things.
What things?
He felt her kissing his head.
Everything you do. When you're asleep, you hardly move, and I can take it all in. There's enough time.
Strange.
Her voice was slow. You smell the same awake as you do asleep, did you know that? He propped up his head and looked into her face, grinning.
You...
She started, then looked down. Her smile looked very sad when she looked back up.
I love hearing that sort of nonsense, she said.
He heard the unsaid part.
You mean, you love hearing that sort of nonsense now, but won't at some indeterminate point in the future?
He hated the awful triteness of it, but she had her own scars.
I suppose, she said,
holding one of his hands.
You think too much about the future.
Maybe we cancel out each other's obsessions then.
He laughed. I suppose I walked into that one.
She touched his face, studied his eyes.
I really shouldn't fall in love with you, Zakalwey.
Why not?
Lots of reasons. All the past and all the future, because you are who you are and I am who I am. Just everything.
Details, he said, waving one hand.
She laughed, shaking her head and burying it in her own hair. She surfaced and gazed up at him.
I just worry it won't last.
Nothing lasts, remember?
I remember.
She nodded slowly.
You think this won't last?
Right now, it feels... I don't know. But if we ever want to hurt each other,
then let's not do that, he said.
She lowered her eyelids, bent her head to him, and he put out his hand and cradled her head.
Maybe it is that simple, she said. Perhaps I like to dwell on what might happen so as never to be surprised.
She brought her face up to his.
Does that worry you?
She said, her head shaking, an expression very like pain around her eyes.
What?
He leant forward to kiss her, smiling, but she moved her head to indicate she did not want to, and he drew back while she said,
But I can't believe enough not to have doubts.
No, I don't worry about that. He did kiss her.
Strange that taste buds have no taste,
she murmured into his neck.
They laughed together.
Sometimes at night, lying there in the dark when she was asleep or silent, he thought he saw the real ghost of Sheradanin Zakalwey come walking through the curtain walls, dark and hard and holding some huge deadly gun, loaded and set. The figure would look at him, and the air around him seemed to drip with, worse than hate, derision. At such moments, he was conscious of himself lying there with her, lying as love-struck and besotted as any youth, lying there wrapping his arms around a beautiful girl, talented and young, for whom there was nothing he wouldn't do, and he knew perfectly and completely that to what he had been, to what he had become, or always was, that sort of unequivocal, selfless, retreating devotion was an act of shame, something that had to be wiped out. And the real Zakalwey would raise his gun, look him in the eye through the sights and fire, calmly and unhesitatingly. But then he would laugh and turn to her, kiss her or be kissed, and there was no threat and no danger under this sun or any other that could take him from her then.
Don't forget we've got to go up to that Cree today. Well, this morning, in fact.
Oh, yes, he said.
He rolled onto his back. She sat up and stretched her arms out, yawning, forcing her eyes wide and glaring up at the fabric roof. Her eyes relaxed, her mouth closed. She looked at him, rested her elbow on the head of the bed, and combed his hair with her fingers.
It probably isn't stuck, though.
Maybe not, he agreed.
It might not be there when we look today.
Indeed.
If it is still there, we'll go up, though.
He nodded, reached up, took her hand clasped. She smiled, quickly kissed him, and then sprang out of the bed and walked to the far level. She opened the waving translucent drapes and unslung a pair of field glasses from a hook on a frame pole. He lay and watched her as she brought the glasses to her eyes, surveyed the hillside above.
"Still there," she said.
Her voice was far away. He closed his eyes. "We'll go up today. Maybe in the afternoon."
"We should."
"Far away." "All right." Probably the stupid animal hadn't got stuck at all. More than likely it had dozed off into an absent-minded hibernation. They did that, so he heard. They just stopped eating and looked ahead and stared with their big dumb eyes at something and closed them sleepily and went into a coma, purely by accident. The first rain or a bird landing on it would probably wake it. Perhaps it was stuck, though. The Cree had thick coats and they got entangled with the bushes and tree branches sometimes and couldn't move. They would go up today. The view was pleasant, and anyway, he could do with some exercise that wasn't mostly horizontal. They would lie on the grass and talk, and look out to the sea, sparkling in the haze, and maybe they would have to free the animal, or wake it up, and she would look after it with a look he knew not to disturb, and in the evening she would write, and that would be another poem. As a nameless lover, he had appeared in many of her recent works, though, as usual, she would throw the bulk of them away. She said she would write a poem specifically about him one day, maybe when he had told her more about his life. The house whispered, moved in its parts, waving and flowing, spreading light and dimming it. The varying thicknesses and strengths of drape and curtain that formed the walls and divisions of the place rustled against each other secretly, like half-heard conversations. Far away, she put her hand to her hair, pulled one side absently, as she moved papers on the desk around with one finger. He watched. Her finger stirred through what she'd written yesterday, toying with the parchments, circling them around slowly, slowly flexing and turning, watched by her, watched by him. The glasses hung from her other hand, straps down, forgotten, and he wandered a long, slow gaze over her as she stood against the light. Feet, legs, behind, belly, chest, breasts, shoulders, neck, face and head and hair. The finger moved on the desktop where she would write a short poem about him in the evening, one he would copy secretly in case she wasn't happy with it and threw it out. And as his desire grew and her calm face saw no finger move, one of them was just a passing thing, just a leaf pressed between the pages of the other's diary. And what they had talked themselves into, they could be silent out of.
"I must do some work today," she said to herself. There was a pause.
"Hey," he said.
"Hmm?"
Her voice was far away. "Let's waste a little time, hmm?"
"A nice euphemism, sir,"
she mused distantly. He smiled. "Come and help me think of better ones." She smiled, and they both looked at each other. There was a long pause. Chapter 6. Swaying slightly, scratching his head, he put the gunstock down on the floor of the small bay, held the weapon by its barrel, and squinted one-eyed into the muzzle, muttering.
"Zakalwe," Dizyat Smar said. "We diverted 28 million people and a trillion tons of spaceship 2 months off course to get you to Verenhertz on time. I'd appreciate it if you'd wait until the job is done before you blow your brains out."
He turned round to see Smar and the drone entering the rear of the small bay. A travel tube capsule flicked away behind them. "Eh?" he said, then waved. "Oh, hi." He wore a white shirt, sleeves rolled up, black pantaloons, and nothing on his feet. He picked the plasma rifle up, shook it, banged it on the side with his free hand, and sighted down the length of the small bay. He steadied, squeezed the trigger. Light flared briefly. The gun leapt back at him, and there was an echoing snap of noise. He looked down to the far end of the bay, 200 meters away, where a glittering black cube, perhaps 15 meters to a side, sat under the overhead lights. He peered at the distant black object, pointed the gun at it again, and inspected the magnified view on one of the gun's screens.
"Weird," he muttered, and scratched his head.
There was a small tray floating at his side. It held an ornate metal jug and a crystal goblet. He took a drink from the goblet, staring intently at the gun.
"Zakalwe," Smar said, "what exactly are you doing?"
"Target practice," he said.
He drank from the goblet again.
"You want a drink, Smar? I'll order another glass."
"No, thanks."
Smar looked down to the far end of the bay at the strange and gleaming black cube.
"And what is that?"
"Ice," Scaffin Amtiscor said.
"Yeah," he nodded, putting the goblet down to adjust something on the plasma rifle. "Ice."
"Dyed black ice,"
the drone said.
"Ice," Smar said, nodding but none the wiser. "Why ice?" "Because," he said, sounding annoyed, this ship, with the incredibly silly name and its 28 trillion people and its hyperzillion billion squintillion tonnage, hasn't got any decent rubbish, that's why."
He flicked a couple of switches on the side of the rifle, aimed again.
"Trillion fucking tons, and it hasn't got any goddamn garbage, apart from its brain, I suppose."
He squeezed the trigger again. His shoulder and arm were pushed back once more, while the light flickered from the weapon's muzzle and sound stuttered. He stared at the view in the sight screen.
"This is ridiculous," he said.
"But why are you shooting at ice?"
Smar insisted.
"Smar," he cried, "are you deaf? Because this parsimonious pile of junk claims it hasn't got any rubbish on board it can let me shoot at."
He shook his head, opened an inspection panel on the side of the weapon.
"Why not shoot at target hollows like everybody else?" Smar asked.
"Hollows are all very well, Dizyet, but..."
He turned and presented her with a gun.
"Here, hold this a minute, will you?
Thanks." He fiddled with something inside the inspection panel while Smar held the gun in both hands. The plasma rifle was a metre and a quarter long and very heavy.
"Hollows are all right for calibration and that sort of crap, but for getting the feel of a weapon, you have to really... really waste something, you know?"
He glanced at her.
"You have to feel the kick and see the debris. Real debris. Not this holographic shit. The real stuff."
Smar and the drone exchanged looks.
"You hold this cannon," Smar said to the machine.
Scaffin Amtiscor's fields were glowing pink with amusement. It took the weight of the gun from her while the man continued to tinker with the weapon's insides.
"I don't think a general systems vehicle thinks in terms of junk, Zakalwe,"
Smar said, sniffing dubiously at the contents of the ornately worked metal jug. She wrinkled her nose.
"Just matter that's currently in use and matter that's available to be recycled and turned into something else to be used. No such thing as rubbish."
"Yeah," he muttered. "That's the crap it came out with as well."
"Gave you ice instead, eh?" the drone said.
"Had to settle for it."
He nodded, clicking the armoured inspection panel back into place and lifting the gun out of the drone's grip.
"Should take a hit, all right, but now I can't get the damn gun to work."
"Zakalwe," the drone sighed. "It would hardly be surprising if it isn't working. The thing belongs in a museum. It's 1,100 years old. We make pistols that are more powerful nowadays."
He sighted, carefully, breathed smoothly, then smacked his lips, put the gun down and took a drink from the goblet. He looked back at the drone.
"But this thing's beautiful," he told the machine, taking up the gun and flourishing it.
He slapped the weapon's darkly cluttered side.
"I mean, take a good look at it. It looks powerful."
He gave an admiring growl, then took up his stance again and shot. This firing fared no better than the others. He sighed and shook his head, staring at the weapon.
"It's not working," he said plaintively. "It just isn't working. I'm getting recoil, but it just isn't working."
"May I?"
Scaffin Amtiscor said. It floated towards the gun. The man looked suspiciously at the drone, then he turned the gun over to it. The plasma rifle flashed from every available screen. Things clicked and beeped. The inspection panels flicked open and shut, and then the drone gave the gun back to the man.
"It's in perfect working order," it said.
"Huh?"
He held the weapon in one hand, up and out from his body, then slapped the back of the stock with his other hand, whirling the big rifle round so that it spun like a rotor in front of his face and chest. He didn't take his eyes off the drone while he did this. He was still looking at the machine when he twisted his wrist, brought the gun to a stop, already aimed straight at the distant black cube of ice, and fired it, all in one smooth action. Again, the gun seemed to fire, but the ice sat undisturbed.
"The hell it's working," he said.
"How exactly did your conversation with the ship go when you asked for your rubbish?" the drone inquired.
"I don't remember," he said loudly. "I told it what a complete cretin it was for not having some junk to shoot at, and it said when people wanted to shoot at real shit, they usually used ice. So I said, 'All right then, you scumbag rocket,' or something like that. 'Give me some ice.'"
He held out his hands expressively.
That was all.
He dropped the gun. The drone caught it.
"Try asking it to clear the bay for firing practice," it suggested. "Specifically, ask it to clear a space in its trapdoor coverage."
He accepted the gun from the drone, looking disdainful.
"All right," he said slowly.
He looked about to say something else, talking into mid-air, then looked uncertain. He scratched his head, glanced at the drone, and appeared to be about to talk to it, then looked away again. Finally, he jabbed a finger at Scaffin Amtiscor.
You ask for all that. It'll sound better coming from another machine."
"Very well. It's done," the drone said. "You only had to ask."
"Hmm," he said.
He switched his suspicious look from the drone to the distant black cube. He lifted the gun and aimed at the icy mass. He fired. The gun rammed back against his shoulder, and a blinding flash of light threw his shadow behind him. The sound was like a grenade going off. A pencil-thin white line seared the length of the small bay and joined the gun to the 15-meter cube of ice, which shattered into a million fragments in a floor-thumping detonation of light and steam and a furiously blossoming cloud of black vapor. Smar stood, her hands clasped behind her back, and watched debris fountain 50 meters to the top of the bay, where it ricocheted off the roof. More black shrapnel flew the same distance to crash into the bay's sidewalls, and tumbling, glittering black shards slithered across the floor towards them. Most skidded to a stop on the ridged surface of the bay, though a few small pieces, blown a long way through the air before thumping